A brief review up here, as I have each time. I know I'm just hammering these journeys, but they're, you know, fairly simple to remember. If you have missed some of the classes, you might want to just make some notes about the actual scripture references here. The first journey is C-shaped. We talked about that. I'm not going to do much time on it, but it is Acts chapters 13 and 14. That one's really easy to remember, so you can find it quite readily. The second and third journeys don't lay out as easily. So it's a good idea probably to go to Acts 15:40, right in the margin there, start the second journey, and then find 18:22, or you can put end second journey, and then therefore start of the third. So we're through all of those. It looks to me like we're perfectly on track to do one chapter a week, and pretty comfortably, really, I think we can do that to pass through the summer then and come into our fall series. So the pace won't be quite so fast as it was maybe 2 and 3 years, 3 weeks back. My, how time flies. Okay. And then you'll remember we started last week into this larger section. Starting at Acts 21, verse 27, Paul is arrested in the city of Jerusalem, and he'll spend the next 4.5 years in varying forms of captivity. Despite the fact that he's under arrest, he's going to be even subject to attacks upon his life, one of which we know of, the scripture records. We'll be talking about that today. And I mentioned again, in case you weren't here, bound with ropes would actually be comfortable. The first time they bind him is with two chains, and so sometimes his circumstances are most uncomfortable, as any chaining would be. But then, in the course of these 4.5 years, he'll also have sometimes that are quite comfortable. He'll be living in a home of his own. He'll be able to receive guests. He's under house arrest. He's going through the Roman system waiting, you know, for various trials. So, you know, it ranges from life-threatening and very uncomfortable to really quite comfortable, as if you're living in your own home. And he's going to accomplish a lot of teaching in the course of these years. Some of Paul's longer sermons are recorded in chapters 21 through 28. Now, we saw again this last week, this picture, I realized for those of you in the back, and it's not all that clear, is one of the best drawings or artist renditions of what this may have looked like. But I really like this particular one, because as Paul is entering into Jerusalem there, trying to make peace with the Jews who are not Christians, as well as with the Jewish Christians, by fulfilling a vow, which was a good idea, they thought, from some of the saints there in Jerusalem. It backfires upon him. And so Paul is first, they say, laying hands on him. You know, he's grabbed. He is dragged, the scripture tells us. He is beaten, the scripture tells us, by the mob. He then is rescued, you know, in the form of an arrest by the Roman authorities. And then, of course, he wears those two chains that we talked about. This picture, though, is so great because it does show the staircase. It gives us an idea, then, of this staircase, which did lead up to a very heavily fortified, very secure barracks, is the term the New American Standard uses, but it's a fort that's immediately adjacent, shares a wall there with the Temple Mount itself, where Paul had, of course, been involved in this fulfillment of this vow. He's identified then by this Roman soldier as not being the insurrectionist that he had had to deal with earlier, and so he gives Paul permission to address that mob. And here again is another artist's rendition of that presentation. And again, I particularly like it because once more, of course, it's got the staircase here, but you can see faces down here is what they're trying to show. Paul may have had, you know, 1,000 or more people that he would be able to address. And so from that location, they would have all been packed in tightly, such as we never do on, you know, our meetings. We get spread out, you know, nice and easy, and it takes a lot of space. But that probably the assembly we have right now, I'm guessing, would pretty easily fit shoulder to shoulder in just the first 3 or 4 rows that we have right here. And so when you pack people in standing up, you know, in tights, even less space, essentially 1 per square foot, I've been in this area. Don and I both, you know, have walked about in Jerusalem here, so the topography's changed quite a bit. But Paul's addressing very likely a very, very large crowd at this time, and all he does is tell his conversion story. This is the second of 3 times that he will do that. We're very familiar with that story, so we were able to work through it rather easily. But in 21 verses, Paul tells the story of his conversion. Of course, it all explodes when he mentions his being chosen by God to go to the Gentiles. So the crowd erupts again. He has to be rescued again. He's actually taken into the barracks now. He's prepared for a beating. And again, I really like this particular picture because, difficult that maybe, it actually makes an attempt at showing how this, what we might call a cat of nine tails, but it didn't have nine, was designed with separate leather straps that would have something tied into the end. They might use a bent nail, they might use tooth from various animals, they might have just used a rock, but they were using things tied into the end of these straps, which were designed, as you know, from the beating that Jesus experienced, to do a great deal more damage to the flesh than just the strap itself would, which in itself, is devastating, but this is designed to peel the flesh, just to strip it off so that as you, strike, it kind of bites, and as you pull your arm back, it's tearing the flesh. Paul experienced none of that, but he was prepared for it. He then reveals at the last possible minute, maybe for dramatic effect, that he is a Roman. This terrifies the soldiers. What they're doing is illegal on two levels. That he is a Roman. He shouldn't be subject to this kind of treatment, but he also has not received a trial. And so they're just scared to death about it. And so immediately he is released from that particular bondage. And then the Sanhedrin is ordered to assemble. So the Roman authorities, they have all the police power there, the military power, the political power. They inform the Sanhedrin, you guys are going to be here tomorrow, and we're going to take care of this problem. So, coming now to Acts chapter 23, Paul's going to face a bunch of guys who probably did a whole lot like that. He has not got a friend in the room. These people hate him, they hate his Lord, and they hate everybody that has named the name of Jesus the Christ. They have had nothing but problems for years with these people who are called Christians. These people are a threat to their authority, a threat to their power, a threat to their income. They're a threat to them in every sense that you can imagine. And so when Paul is now hauled in before this Sanhedrin, remember that among these men will be likely many, if not possibly actually all of those, who would feel personally betrayed by him because they had given him the authority clear up to the level of high priest to go to Damascus and to persecute Christians over there. That was his job. What did he do on the way? He sold out. And he went from having our authority as the highest, judicial and religious authorities in the land to persecute Christians. He's become one of them, and worse, he has become their most effective proponent of this new doctrine. And worse, he has now suggested that the Jewish traditions and actions are unnecessary for Gentiles who are being fully welcomed and embraced, in this new religious system. Brethren, it would be hard to design more offense for these men. So when they've now got their hands on Paul, they've been waiting years for this. And if they could, every one of them, their laying hands on Paul would have been around his neck and with great vigor. Okay? So when he walks into this room, he is facing a hostile audience. He's under arrest. He can't defend himself, physically. He can't flee. And so the poor man, is just as helpless as you can get. These have got to be really difficult circumstances that we can just only imagine. And so, in chapter 23 and verse 1, it said Paul looked how at the council? He looked intently at this council. Now at this moment, he has received the promise, as had the other apostles, that their responsibility was to go to kings and those in authority. And they had been warned, Paul personally, that he would have problems in Jerusalem. So it's not like he's unprepared for this. And they had been told that in that moment they would be given the words to speak. So while Paul is looking intently at this audience, I really doubt that he is looking at them in fear. Paul is a man who's been through some things. Paul is a man who's been here before. He knows how bad it can hurt. He's been stoned and dragged out of the city dead. He's been through a lot. But he is also here well aware that he now has before him the most powerful men in the entire country of Israel. And he has the opportunity now that had been promised him for some time. He can fulfill this opportunity to speak to these men. So you can imagine, everybody is very tense and intense. And now Paul faces this group of people, and he says this. First thing, brethren. Now we've seen this before. Paul's every effort, whether it's Jew or Gentile, is first to make peace and to make friends, to find common ground. Paul in chapter 17 did the same thing with a bunch of idolaters. I see you're very religious. It's a compliment. Well, their very religiousness, he would seek to destroy. It's an abomination in the sight of God. That's true. But still, you can be cordial, and you can start off, you know, trying to find common ground, settle people down, get them to relax. They're much more likely, you know, to hear what you have to say. The brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. Now some tell me, you tell me, when Paul says that, what do you suppose the reaction would be? I have lived my life, you're the audience, with a perfectly clean conscience to this day. How would they receive that?
Those aren't the words I would have used. They're a lot better than mine.
Yeah, right. Okay, Carol?
Well, it just falls on the will of
the
I mean, you're not going to
hear
a word
Now see, and that's exactly right. And this, yeah, right, first, because they betrayed him. But as Carol's just pointed out now, you know, you've got a group of people that have every reason to despise this man, you know, to the height. And so you say you have a perfectly clean conscience. Well, we're here to tell you that it cannot possibly be the case. So, what have we got? We've got, you know, brethren, in a declaration that I'm honest. But I too think that that would be met with, you know, next door to rage, because they cannot conceive that that is possible. You can't do what you've done, Paul, and be honest about it. Okay? But this is the point that Paul is going to try to make. He has declared that what he has not done for personal gain. He was not using those men when he asked for that power to go to Damascus. He has done nothing that is untoward. He has only done that which he felt was necessary. He will then, you know, be met with verse 2, the high priest, Ananias, commanding those beside him to strike him where? Okay? And that must have been some kind of a blow, don't you think? This was delivered in anger, whoever delivered it. It would have been delivered with great vigor. I can imagine it just spun Paul's head, you know, when he was cracked upside by this individual, whoever it was that was detailed to do it. So you can just only imagine, he was pounded with this stroke. And in verse 3, then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. And do you sit to try me according to the law? And in violation of the law, order me to be struck? Well, that's what Carol just pointed out. In good conscience, Paul stands before them. But these men have bent the law, broken the law, and abused the law with everything they could, starting with Jesus, running through the apostles into all of the saints, drove them out in Acts chapter 8 of the very city here, and they have proven themselves to have the hardest, dirtiest consciences that, you know, in the country. and they're the leaders. You might learn something there, you know, about our own political system and any other government's political system, not picking on us in particular, but, you know, you'll discover, and Solomon writes about it in the book of Proverbs, talks about it in Ecclesiastes as well, that, you know, many people seek power because they're corrupt. And they seek that power not for the benefit of the good. Now, many do. And many honest people, you know, I'm not trying to say the system's entirely corrupt by any means, but this is what you're going to face wherever you go is a mixture of these kinds of people. So what Paul says in verse 3, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. It's just a fancy way of saying you're a hypocrite. And God will take you to task for this. You will be punished for this by God himself. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck? Brethren, is there any court in the land where, when a prisoner stands before you and he says, I plead innocent, your first argument is, oh my God, where was the lawyer? You know, where was any sort of, even a response, here's the charges, you know, against you? So it is so tremendously wrong, and everybody in that room knows that. And who's the guy that gave the order? The high priest himself. So you've got the man who is supposed to be the single wisest, most dignified, most devoted, most honest, you know, the man that is supposed to be a paragon of virtue, the man that is the only man who is allowed to come into the temple, into that holy place, and then only once a year. This is supposed to be the epitome of purity and devotion to God. And what does he do when he orders this man to be struck? Break every law in the books. And to do so in the full presence, you know, of the council. And so Paul's got every right to say what he says. This is a crime. This is unjust. This is wrong. This is God's, responsibility to answer here. I can't do anything about it, but he will take care of you. Now, we have this next event, brethren, which has just mystified people for the longest time. Bystander said, do you revile God's high priest? And Paul backs down. Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. And it is difficult. It's hard to understand this. And I really like this particular picture right here. What is wrong?
Well, you Boy Scouts, you know, reading Highlights magazine, you know, with this picture. What is wrong with this picture?
What's this guy wearing? Not on his head. What is that? That's a depiction of the ephod. Okay? Now, I don't think he's supposed to be wearing this around, you know, daily affairs. What was that for? Temple service. Okay? My point being is that we all know it was the high priest, as the scripture tells us, and so we get to thinking in terms of, oh, I remember the high priest, you know, and so he would have been on this full regalia, and how could anybody on the planet possibly not know who he was? Besides, Paul would have known this guy. What's his name? How long's he been high priest? Well, since he was there to condemn Jesus himself, who did Paul get permission from to go to Damascus these some years ago? From him. And from, you know, the council. So our first problem here is, well, how could he not know the guy? Okay? What's the answer to that, brethren? It really is pretty obvious. What's the answer to that? Yeah, in the first place, he's not trying to present himself, the term sure is used in there. He's not trying to make a show of who he was. And as a matter of fact, thinking of wisdom again, some of you like Star Trek. Okay. Now, I've never seen a Star Trek episode where Captain Picard, he is the best commander.
Let there be no argument.
Okay.
So of all the captains of the Enterprise, bar none, you know, he's the best. But at
any rate, you know, he's having a meeting with the Kardashians or somebody, you know, that's mortal enemies. And he's calling in for this dinner engagement. And so in this meeting, Riker, remember number one, okay, he's doing all the talking. And so they're going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth with this ambassador or whoever he was. And then suddenly this ambassador just stops and he goes, And he turns to Picard and he says, I see what you're doing. You know, I mean, I don't remember the actual quotes, but he says, using a subordinate to try to draw me out. Okay? And so the point of all of that was, you know, a wise man, I think, brethren, does not want to lead off, you know, being the guy that's involved with the back and forth. A wise man first wants to know what? He wants to know his opponent. He wants to get as much information as he can. He wants to be prepared. And so, if this high priest is smart, and I'm sure that he is, you know, the smarter thing to do is to go into the council and try to conceal who you are. Huge group of men right here. And so just pass yourself off as any one of them and make an effort even, and some years have passed, you know, to conceal your person. Paul didn't recognize the guy. And that wouldn't be hard at all if that was your intent, and that, you know, because you're kind of landloaded to see what's going to happen before you're going to pull out all your big guns. And now, as a matter of fact, I try to learn from this, and you'll see it in other places. For instance, in Acts 15, when Paul came down for the Jerusalem conference, the way the scripture uses it, in elevation. And so Paul came south from Antioch, up in altitude, to Jerusalem to present that conference. Who spoke first? Who did they let go first? The people that were teaching that you had to be circumcised in order to be saved. They let them have the floor first. They ran their course. Very wise there. Let your enemy, let your opponent, you know, spill the beans. Just let them exhaust their energies as well. And I've been in a little bit of controversy in my life as a preacher, most have, and I've been using this, I don't want to say trick.
Technique.
Technique. That's what I'm looking for. So do you. Technique. I almost came up with ploy, and that sounds bad too. You know, but I've used this technique many, many, many times, and I've seen it work really, really, really well. You don't need to be answering every argument. Draw your opponent out. Get as much information as you can, and two things will happen. You're learning what they've got, okay? But the other thing is, they're actually also tiring themselves out. I've done this dozens and dozens of times. And so I listen to somebody, they're mad at me, and they're going on and on and on, you know, some denomination they're in, I don't know what they're about, you know, but they're going on and on and on, and then when it looks like they're just done, they've exhausted themselves, I'll ask, is there anything else you don't like about the Church of Christ? Is there anything else you don't like about what I've done? Is there, you know, anything else? And usually they'll rise up and go get another point or two, you know, and I just wing them out. And then they've got all of that nervous energy and anger spilled, okay? And then I try to come in very calm, measured, deliberate, and start having a conversation that has all the, you know, the anger drained out of it. It works very, very effectively. So that's one thing. Do you have a hand going up?
Yes, so it's not only, you don't really drain them, you drain their arguments. So you see every point that they have against doing something, so you know how to counterpoint and to calmly, as you say, do something.
See, exactly. Exactly. So Paul didn't know who the guy was. And he would not have presented himself like this. He had no good reason to present himself like this. It's not in his best interest to present himself like that. Well, I like the solid faces, you know, but I don't think one guy was separated like that. So Paul saw some guy hurt him that he didn't identify, and he hasn't met with these men for some years. And so how he was sitting behind somebody else, you know, whatever, gives this order, and he condemns it. And he was right to condemn it. He did the right thing. But then he immediately apologizes and backs down. Well, if he did the right thing, then how come he was apologizing? You got an answer on that? That's the second dilemma we've got to face here. What went down there? Okay. Exactly. What did David do on the two occasions he could have killed Saul? Twice he had that opportunity. He had the man's life in his hands. But what did he say that's very similar to this? Not going to do it, you know, to God's anointed. Not going to do it. It's this Paul recognizes is right. Show respect for the man who is in an office that should be respected and that God put him in. This is mighty difficult much of the time. Gross corruption. Evil people can be in these positions. And you've got one of the worst that ever walked the earth right here. Okay? But when Paul says, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, he was right. However, he didn't know that it was the high priest, and because of the office, should not have spoken like he did. He should have been more measured in his response there. So, he was only wrong, how? Yeah, he was only wrong because the particular individual whom he did not recognize shouldn't be treated that way. But everybody else ought to be. Should have been. And how was the man behaving? Was he behaving like the high priest ought to? No. He was behaving like, you know, this rabid rabble that would just take his life. And so Paul was in a jam right there, and he apologized. He did the right thing. Okay? But he wasn't, you know, out of line. He was mistaken. Big difference. So the reason I spend so much time on this, brethren, what will your friendly neighborhood atheist do with all of this?
Well, this is just, you know, right fodder for them.
Oh, this is great, you know. You're claiming the guy's inspired. Yes, I am, but only when he delivers the message, not this first part. Man wasn't inspired 24/7. He can make mistakes like anybody else can. But, you know, the atheist or the infidel, they're looking at this as just proof positive that Paul, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. He had to apologize. Why would you follow a guy like that? Well, people make mistakes. Peter made a mistake. We hear about in Galatians 2. Paul made a mistake. But it was not a doctrinal error. It was not a failure of inspiration. It was not what people would make out of it. It was a matter of mistaken identity is all in the world that it was. And then he did the right thing, which was what? Apologize, and says in verse 5, I was not aware, brethren, he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. That's Exodus 22, verse 28. You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now let's all of you remember that. You're going to see things, you know, in our political structure that will drive you nuts. And you'll see corruption at some of the highest levels. You're going to see all kinds of, you know, evil that is perpetrated in the name of the law, and when it's a complete miscarriage of justice, you're going to see that all your life. And Solomon said so in the book of Ecclesiastes. But what will a Christian not do? Speak evil of the ruler of the people. Romans 13, who put him there? God did. And though the man may be as corrupt as Ananias, what does the office deserve?
Respect.
Okay? Hard sometimes, but needs to be done. Now, by the way, that only applies
when you're talking, you know, to a high government official, right? That does not apply when saints are just hanging out in a potluck talking, right?
Brethren, that's a pretty blanket statement. You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.
Well, and also, you say that the other argument even if he's on the other side, he will apologize and take a more gracious effort.
Carol's point is just profoundly important, brethren. If you want the law to serve you well, then what? Serve it well. Okay? And so, be respectful of it. And number two, and it's the same idea, though, that she's talking about right there. You know, don't Christians have enough problems with people hating us and the things that we do and the things that we stand for that we would add to it an apparent disrespect for our nation and its laws? People hear you crying out against your nation and your laws and its laws. What do they think of you? See, and you've just given them another strike against you. And we're not going to do that. Christians should be patriotic in a very healthy, you know, proper sense, which is we understand that this is one nation under God, that he put these people into these positions of power, and that included Herod and Pilate and Ananias. These people that were in power, God put them there, Romans 13. They're corrupt and evil. I know it. Saul, the king of the Old Testament, God put him there. See, and so that respect for the law is one less thing that people, you know, would be able easily to charge us with. They're going to do it in their corruption anyway. But this is a big point, brethren, and frankly, I'm hammering on it because I've heard it in this church. I've heard it in every church I've ever been in. We are too loose. We're too critical. And we're entirely too heated sometimes in our rhetoric about our leaders. And so the truth of the matter is, I've seen a lot of corruption and you have too. But I think we do. We just get the loose talk and we're not showing the kind of regard that Paul did right here. So I just want to counsel against it. It's something that is very easily, you step over the line on that. Okay, so Paul apologized. He cited the verse, Exodus 22. But, you know, what he does here next is just wonderful. Perceiving that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." And as he said this, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided, for the Sadducees said, "There is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit," but the Pharisees acknowledged them all. And there arose a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit and angel have spoken to him." A great dissension was developing. The commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them, and ordered the troops to go down, take him away from them by force, bring him into the barracks. What did Paul do? He played them. That's what he did. He knew the composition of this religious body. So he used it. He declared himself to be on one side. He knew full well that that whole thing would erupt like that. Why would he want it to erupt like that? Well, it's divide and conquer is exactly it. Now, how does he conquer? See, the division, how does Paul come out on top of this deal? If he simply goes through a trial, what will the Pharisees and the Sadducees certainly agree on? They may not believe in the resurrection of the Sadducees, but what are they going to agree on? Paul ought to die. That's for sure. That's a given. They can agree on that. So Paul's pleading for his life. Paul sets this off because he knows that Roman soldier that has already rescued him twice is going to do it again. He's a Roman citizen. So, divide and conquer is exactly what he did. He's pulled back in the barracks at the end of verse 10. "In the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, 'Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also.'" Now, it'll be three times total that Paul will actually have a conversation, you know, with the Lord. So this is the second. And so he knows, okay, it's going to turn out all right. I'm going to Rome. Now, 12. And we can read through all this very rapidly. It's just a historical record of how it all went down. "When it was day, The Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul." How legal is that? And who are they talking to? The judges who should be devoted to putting an end to such shenanigans. That's just as illegal as anything you can get. They come for permission to the guys who are supposed to stop it. "Now therefore, you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. We, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near." But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. Now, wouldn't you like to know how? And he came and he entered the barracks and he told Paul. Paul was still free under the Roman law to have visitors. Paul called one of the centurions to him and he said, "Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him." So he took him, led him to the commander, and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you." The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, "What is it you have to report to me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council as though they're going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him, so do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him, and now they're ready and waiting for the promise from you. Therefore, the commander let the young man go, instructing him, 'Tell no one that you've notified me of these things.' He called in two of the centurions and said, 'Get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen.'" It would be about 9 p.m. 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. How many soldiers? 470. Now, that's interesting because it also gives you an idea of just how powerful the military presence of Rome is in Jerusalem. This guy sees that he is facing riot in the whole city. This guy smells insurrection. This guy sees revolt. And in that fact, charged with the task of preventing it, he takes 470 soldiers and does what? Sends them out of town. If he can afford 470 spearmen, horsemen, and soldiers, foot soldiers, to leave town, knowing that when they leave town, they will be taking the guy that everybody in town hates and wants killed, what would he expect is going to happen when the word gets out that Paul has escaped 40 guys starving? And he's got 470 fewer soldiers. What's that tell you about the military presence in Jerusalem? It was huge. He could face the bigger problem and give up 470 chessmen and still feel like he had everything under control. Rome was really there, brethren. Remember that. Okay, so what happens next? We're to 24. He also provided mounts to put Paul on, bring him safely to Felix the governor. He wrote a letter having this form: Claudius Lysias, so now we know the guy's name, to the most excellent governor Felix, over Caesarea Maritima, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, is that the way you remember it? Do you remember the Jews arresting Paul? What were they doing to Paul? They were beating him and going to kill him. Well, I guess you could call that arrest, but, you know, when this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, why would he say that? Now, how does that sound? Does that sound like it was just the natural course of the law being properly fulfilled? Yeah. Why does this soldier represent it that way? Who would it reflect on the way it really happened? It reflects on him. He let this thing get out of hand. So he's covered his own tracks, and he's not being very honest either. This isn't what happened, but he's covered himself. He said, I came upon them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. True or false? It's a blatant lie. Politics being what it is. Okay, so I understand. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, there was no charge. That's lie number three. I brought him down to their council. He didn't do that. And I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. Well, that's two times he's right. 3-2 now. And when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So he tells three lies, and he tells three truths. This is Claudius Lysias to Felix. That ends verse 31. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul, brought him by night to Antipatris, and the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked them what province he was, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's Praetorium. Just so you know, how long is he going to be in the Praetorium? Next verse. 5 days. So, chapter 23. It's really a very interesting chapter, but the great majority of it is just Paul moving, you know, over to Caesarea, which I forgot to show you. So, here is Paul being sent to Caesarea Maritima. Got about 1 minute to go through this. Verses 11 through 35. All the pictures I had of Caesarea, this is a new one I just found. I really love this. Okay, so this is looking along the coastline from south to north, an artist's rendition of Caesarea Maritima. Note the big Colosseum, the palace that the Roman authorities were in and where their barracks would be, the hippodrome where the horse races took place, and I've walked on that, it's very readily identifiable. The world-famous port, which is a marvel of engineering. The temple to the Roman gods and Caesars, and then, you know, the rest of the city itself. Now, this is the way that looks today and lines up very closely. Here is the actual same amphitheater that has endured these 2,000 years. Here's the promontory on which the palace was built. Though because of tsunamis and the ravages of the sea for 2,000 years, it's no longer standing. There's remnants, foundations, but that's all. The hippodrome, you can see its walls right here. Okay? So there's the hippodrome, and there are still remnants of the center parts around which the horses race. And then this is where the harbor was, but that's only the inner harbor. There was another one that stretched out farther to sea that rendition also does not show. So here's an aerial that perfectly parallels that. All right, and then I realize I'm just over, but if we zoom in right here, this is where we'll close. Now, Paul is going to be held here in these buildings. And so this is where he is, Caesarea Maritima, the Caesarea that's by the sea, going to be there for 5 days, and now it's coming up to the level of governor. Any quick comment or question? All right, great. Thank you very much, then. We'll do it again in 10 minutes.